Hello, everyone, and welcome to Crush Course, the podcast for the wine curious. I'm your host, Sarah, coming to you from Sonoma Valley, California, and this week we are continuing our fermentation series. If you haven't already, please be sure to check out our part one for all things red fermentation. This week, we are tackling white wine and rosé. So, let's get to it, shall we? So a quick recap of the different fermentation types. For red wines, we ferment the juice and the grape skins all together, making sure to get out all those lovely aromatic compounds, color, and tannin from the skins before we drain and press off the wine. But for both white and rosé, we ferment just the juice. The skins have already been pressed off or removed before we even start the fermentation. When we get the fruit, we are immediately dumping it into a press to squeeze out all the juice from the skins and the seeds. While any sort of press can be used at this step, I've most often seen wineries use this thing called a membrane press. They're pretty popular, and I think they're actually really cool. It's basically a giant slotted metal cylinder that essentially has a massive balloon inside of it. This is the membrane in membrane press. We put the grapes into that space in between the cylinder and the membrane, and we slowly inflate the balloon. We do this in press fractions, same as with a red wine. The first press fraction will be when we've just broken the skin and we're starting to see some of the juice come out of the press and into the press pan. This is an open tub that we use to catch the juice before pumping it off into its next vessel. Just as with the different press fractions after a red fermentation, these press fractions will have some differences in the chemistry of the juice that we get out of it. Whereas tannins were the main concern in red press fractions, the main concerns with pressing juice off of skins is phenolic extraction and increased pH. Phenolics contribute mouthfeel to the wine, but when overextracted, they can make for bitterness and a drying effect in the finished wine. We get phenolic extraction from the skins and the seeds, so the more gentle the pressing of the fruit, the less phenolic extraction. The same goes for pH. The harder we press the fruit, the more the pH will increase. As the pH increases, that beautiful brightness we love in whites and rosés will decrease. But again, as with red wines, we don't want to waste any of what we are given. So the different press fractions are separated into different fermentation vessels. Before that, we do add just a wee bit of sulfur and dry ice into that press pan to prevent any oxidation, essentially browning of the wine, before we can start the fermentation. While this is the tried and true method for getting white juice from fruit to tank, this is just one of the ways that we can get the juice for a rosé wine. Last week we talked about saunier, a technique used in red fermentations to increase the skin-to-juice ratio prior to fermentation. This isn't just a couple bottles worth of wine that we are taking out from the red tank. It can be as much as half of the tank's volume to really make a difference in skin extraction. We can't just dump that down the drain. For one thing, that would result in a hugely negative impact in local waterways where our drains let out, but also, it's literally throwing money down the drain. So a lot of winemakers will actually take advantage of this and use the juice taken out of the tank for the saunier and ferment it as a rosé wine. Pretty nifty, right? I always say, waste not, want not. The benefit of a saunier rosé is significantly lower phenolics and a preserved natural acidity, but if the grapes were picked specifically for a red wine, it will be likely higher in alcohol and lower in overall acidity than grapes picked specifically for a rosé in mind. So while it's thrifty, the resulting rosé can lack some of those lovely qualities we search for in a rosé, the delicate acidity, those lovely aromatics, and the semi-sweet, fruity touch on the palate. For my rosé fiends out there, I would highly recommend taking a saunier rosé and a traditional rosé to compare for yourself. Before we get into the fermentation stage, I also wanted to touch on orange wine. We've talked about the red, the white, and the rosé, But how do we get the orange? Simply put, an orange wine is a white wine in which the juice is not pressed off the skins right away. We sort of treat it as if it were a red wine. Sometimes the skin stays for just a few days, sometimes throughout the entire fermentation, and sometimes even beyond that. The color compounds in white grapes are leached out of the skins and into the fermenting juice, which creates this lovely amber color. For many years, this sort of coloring was considered unattractive, unwanted, and unmarketable for white wines, but they really experienced a boom in popularity recently. I am still sort of dipping my toes into the world of orange wine. They're still a bit hard to come by, even at my local shops, but I am very excited to see where this trend goes. We now have our juice, and the next big process is juice clarification. So the juice that we are getting out of the press will still be quite cloudy on account of the presence of grape particles or solids. If left in the fermentation, these could make the wine heavy, harsh, or overly herbaceous. So we want clean juice to make clean wine. Many winemakers use a chill, settle, rack, or CSR technique to get rid of these solids. What are we talking about when we say solids here? Well, these will mostly be composed of, and bear with me here, polysaccharides, lipids, minerals, pectin, and some nitrogen and phenolic compounds. These are going to be coming from the skins and the pulp of the berry. After 24 to 48 hours of intense chilling, the heaviest of these solids will settle out to the very bottom, with lighter solids setting just above that, then a large volume of pristine, nearly clear juice at the top. Juice solids can have a huge impact on fermentation and its byproducts. If you want a slower, more controlled fermentation, you want to have lower solids in the juice. But if there isn't enough solids, the fermentation might get stuck. You see, the yeast actually needs some solids to bind to. In particular, the lipids or fats and the nitrogen compounds act almost as a booster shot to ensure a good, steady fermentation. Each winemaker has their own thresholds, and it's oftentimes varietal dependent. For instance, with Chardonnay, it's common to, as they say, rack the fluffies into the fermentation vessel. Whereas for a Riesling, you want a very clean rack with no solids at all. From here, we have a few more choices at this next step, the fermentation vessel. Since we are dealing with just the juice, we don't have to worry about the logistics of pressing the skins later. But because we don't have skins, white wines metaphorically have a lot more flexibility in what vessels we can use. We can use tanks, just like red fermentation, and again, they can be made from oak, stainless steel, or concrete. But we have some fun options if we want to go a bit smaller in size. The benefit of doing white wine fermentations in smaller vessels is that you have even more control over the fermentation than in a larger tank. But it can be hard to accomplish this at larger wineries. However, it is not impossible. At the winery I worked at in Australia, they had multiple Indiana Jones-esque warehouses packed to the ceiling with fermenting barrels. The first option is actually fermenting in oak barrels. This is very popular in Napa when making Chardonnay, so that we can get a jump start on creating that toasty, oaky, nutty profile. Or perhaps a winemaker wants the smaller volume, but no oak. In that case, they may utilize stainless steel drums, which look just like barrels, but they're made from stainless steel. Just like their tank counterparts, stainless steel drums allow for the juice and the yeast to create a unique profile in the wine without the interference of oak. Another option, if you don't want to use oak barrels, are these trendy new vessels called concrete eggs. So imagine an egg-shaped tank, about 6 feet tall, made out of concrete. These have become very popular in the last 5 years or so for aromatic white varieties, where we don't want oak influence, but stainless steel isn't quite giving it the oomph we want. Before we introduce our friends, the Yeasty Boys, we have a brief window of opportunity with the juice to do a bit of tweaking. What sort of tweaking? Well, the main thing we're concerned with here is acid. Remember, the development of sugars in the berry is inversely related to the development of acid. More alcohol means less acid, and vice versa. While our goal with white wines is never to make anything too boozy, white wines are typically in the 11 to 13% alcohol range. There is always the chance that the acids may have been depleted or may not be what we want them to be. We'll typically run analysis on the juice to determine acid levels and pH, and depending on the winemaker's decision, we may add acid, most commonly in the form of tartaric acid, but also sometimes citric acid. Fun fact, it's basically the same stuff that coats Sour Patch Kids. Some other chemistry may be adjusted at this time, but once we have it honed in, we can add the yeast. Same as before, we take the dehydrated yeast and bring them back to life with some hot water and nutrients. We take out some juice from the tank to bring the slurry closer to the temperature of the tank, and then we lovingly throw them in. For the barrels and drums, we have to divvy up the mixture and add it to the vessels individually. As the fermentation gets going, we start monitoring Brix and temperature. Even though we don't have skin extraction to worry about, we are still keeping a close eye on temperature and keeping it in a very appropriate range for the yeast. Last week, I talked about how fermentation is all about making the yeast happy. If the yeast get too hot or they don't have the proper nutrients, they get stressed. And when they get stressed, they start producing these things we call off aromas. You know how wine is always described with lovely adjectives like lime zest and candied pears and lemongrass? Well, there are also unpleasant descriptors for wine, like rotten eggs and sweaty gym socks. No, it doesn't sound like something I'd want to drink either. To keep the yeast happy and prevent the production of these off aromas, we keep the temperature of the fermentation within a certain range and add fermentation nutrients along the way. If the yeast don't get proper nutrients, the wine may start showing signs of reduction. This is where that sweaty gym sock aroma comes from. As the yeast do their work, they will eventually start to die off because yeast actually can't survive in an alcoholic environment. When the yeast die off, they become lees. It's sort of a silty, sandy gunk that settles at the bottom of the tank. Much like red wines and their skins, there's a decision to be made about when to take the wine off of the lees, and whether or not we want to take a little bit of the lees with us into the new vessel. Even though they are the remains of dead yeast cells, there is some benefit to keeping the wine on some or all of the lees after fermentation. Lees contact makes for a round, creamy palate in the finished wine, but a wine left on lees too long can potentially go reductive and stinky. As with most things in winemaking, we have to trust our sense of smell and taste to determine when is the time to pull the trigger. After we have separated the wine, or racked it off, the lees, we are again faced with a few choices about what we can do before bottling and distribution. With creamy, rich wines like Napa Chardonnay, we will likely keep the wine in oak barrels and will have the wine undergo malolactic fermentation. This is another type of fermentation, but this time with a bacteria called Enococcus aeni, and rather than turning sugar into alcohol, they are converting malic acid into lactic acid. Malic acid is one of the main acids that develop in grapes and is much more of that tart green apple acidity, whereas lactic acid is much smoother and creamier, kind of like yogurt. So green apple to yogurt. That's all you need to know about malolactic fermentation. While Napa Chardonnay is all about getting all that creaminess and toastiness, a lot of white wines and rosés are more acid-driven, and we want to preserve that, along with the fruity and floral characteristics. For these, we will oftentimes forego malolactic fermentation and keep the wine in stainless steel until it is time to bottle. Once we are given the thumbs up and it's time to bottle, the wine can be filtered to get the last of the lees out of there, leaving a crystal clear, delicious wine for you to enjoy. White and rosé fermentation processing is not all that unlike red wine. Just a few things have been switched out. Rather than concerning ourselves with tannins, we are more concerned about phenolics and acid. And while skin extraction is our main concern with red wine, with rosé and white, we keep the fermentation nice and cool to preserve aromatics. But same as before, It's all a matter of style, and each decision we face can lead to a plethora of exciting and delicious opportunities. Another question was sent in this last week from Alyssa Can Draw on Instagram. She wants to know, why is there sediment sometimes at the bottom of the bottle? Does that mean there's something wrong with the wine? So there are actually a few potential causes for any sort of sediment or deposits at the bottom of a bottle of wine. The first is that the wine may not have been filtered, leaving a good percentage of lees and other fermentation byproducts in the wine. Winemakers may choose to do this because they believe that fining and filtering practices are just too aggressive, and they strip the wine of unique, delicate aromatics and flavor characteristics. So rather than sacrifice it, they just leave it au naturel. The second is that there is some sort of instability in the wine. The two main forms of chemical instability that we see in bottle are potassium and protein. Potassium instability will often present as these tiny little crystals at the bottom of the bottle, whereas protein will create a sort of haziness to the wine. We typically see this after the wine has been in hot temperatures for too long. No matter which of these are present in a wine, it is perfectly safe to drink. However, if a wine has been heated enough to form a protein haze, it is likely cooked and will sort of taste like cooked or stewed fruit. Again, not dangerous, but won't be a true representation of the wine. I'd say in that case, best to pop a different bottle. Keep sending us those questions into our Instagram at Crush Course Podcast, and make sure to give us a follow and a like while you're there. It's time for our wine of the week. Another reason I love this time of year is the fall release for my wine clubs. It's almost like a biannual present to myself. The wine of the week I wanted to highlight is the 2019 Chenin Blanc from Pax Wines in Sebastopol, California. I first visited Pax around this time last year and immediately fell in love with their wines. Not only are they working with some really fun varieties that you don't typically see in the bottle shop, but they just put so much love and care into their wine, and it really shows. One of the bottles I got in my fall release is their 2019 Chenin Blanc, coming from Buddhist Dharma's Vineyard in the Northern California coast. Nice, cool climates like these are my favorite because they make for a slow and gentle growing season, allowing all these wonderful aromatics and acids to develop. I was absolutely blown away by this vintage when I tasted it a few weeks ago. Green apple and pear, lemon zest, and a bit peachy. Again, great acidity and well-rounded thanks to spending nearly a full year in French and Austrian oak. We will tackle how different wood origins can impact the finished wine in our oak episode in a few weeks. Since Pax is such a small production winery, it's not guaranteed how long they'll have this particular vintage in stock. If you can, swing by their tasting room in Sebastopol or check out their website to inquire about availability. If you can't get your hands on this particular bottle, I would highly encourage you to pick up a bottle of Chenin Blanc the next time you're hunting for a white wine. It's one of my all-time favorite white varieties, and I don't think it gets nearly enough love and appreciation. That just about covers it for this week. We are officially more than halfway through our fermentation series and have just one more to go: sparkling wine. For those of you who don't know, I currently work at a winery that specializes in sparkling wine, so next week's episode will be a special kind of geek out. Not only will I go into how it's made, but I'll be including some quick tips for picking the right sparkling for any occasion or taste preference. I'm Sarah, and this has been your Crush Course on white wine and rosé fermentation. And until next time, cheers!